Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
We're very excited tonight to have James Scott here with his debut novel that I have to add right away. Has gotten so much attention that I can't wait to go home and pick it up again. I've just started it, and you're already, once you start it, you just can't let go of it. The book everyone is talking about is The Kept. Independent booksellers and librarians who were lucky enough to read an advanced copy before it came out are embracing The Kept and telling others about it. It's a brutal and yet tender story that takes place in upstate New York in 1897. Publishers Weekly gave it a starred review and said, James Scott has produced a work of historical fiction that is both atmospheric and memorable, suffused with dread and suspense right up to the last page. Without further ado, will you please join me in welcoming James Scott?
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Marty, for that wonderful introduction. This is my first reading for my first book, so it's very exciting for me, and especially to be at such an amazing independent bookstore. I got embroiled in a pretty aggressive game of Marco Polo with some children at the hotel pool today. And they were wondering why I wasn't working, because their dad had stuff to do in the meeting room. And I told them, I said, well, I'm a writer. And most of them were not interested or, you know, thought it was lame or whatever, but one of them was like, a writer, that's cool. And I thought, you know what, it is cool. And tonight I really feel like one for the first time. It's so incredible to be here. And I have to thank Tattered Cover for not just for bringing me, but for selecting the book as one of their very impressive books for the month of January. For a debut author like me, it's such an enormous deal to have a bookstore throw that kind of support behind you. And it's one of the first things that I'd heard anyone say about the book at that time. And my publicist called, and she was so excited, and I was so excited. And it's just really wonderful. And so I have to thank Marty again for that introduction, and Charles and everyone who works here. It's such a beautiful and amazing bookstore. I couldn't be more thrilled. And I have to thank you all for coming. I know there's lots to do. I know you're probably recovering from the Broncos game on Sunday, and I know the weather wasn't what it was supposed to be. But the idea of getting here safely from Boston to Denver in the middle of January when they scheduled this, I thought, oh, that's probably 50-50 at best. But here I am, and again, I couldn't be happier. So the book is told from two different points of view, one of Elspeth, the mother, and one of her son, Caleb, who's 12. I'm gonna read a little bit from each, and then at the end I'm going to do a little bit that combines the two of them, so you sort of get an idea of the whole book. In a lot of the reviews, which have Marty mentioned some of them, there have been a lot of spoilers, which is fine. I'm so happy that they're reviewing the book at all and that they've gathered their thoughts about it. It's incredible. But I really like surprises as a reader and as a writer. And so I'm going to try and preserve the surprises as best I can. So if something doesn't quite make sense, I assure you, if you read it, it will all come together. And then what else should I say? I don't think there's a whole lot to explain. And because this is the first reading and this is the first night, I figured what better place to start than right at the beginning with chapter one. Elspeth Howell was a sinner. The thought passed over her like a shadow as she washed her face or caught her reflection in a window or disembarked from a train after months away from home. Whenever she saw a church or her husband quoted verse or she touched the simple cross around her neck while she fetched her bags. Her transgressions lay in the hollow of her chest, hard and heavy as stone. The multitude of her sins, anger, covetousness, thievery, created a tension in her body, and all that could ease the pressure was movement, finding something to occupy her wicked hands and her tempted mind. And so she churned her legs against snow that piled in drifts to her waist. While the miles passed, the sky over Elspeth became nothing but a gray smudge, and weighty clouds released their burden. She loosened the scarf from her face, and the cold invaded her lungs. As soon as a drop of sweat slid out from under a glove or down a curl of hair, it turned to ice that flickered in the last of the light. In her pocket, she kept a list of the children's names and ages, the years cross out 2 and 3 times, so that when she brought gifts, she forgot no one. She carried a fish scaler for Amos, 14, a goose collar for Caleb, 12, a hunting knife for Jesse, 10, a 50-inch broadcloth for Mary, 15, a length of purple ribbon for Emma, 6, and a small vial of perfume for both girls to share. Wrapped with care against the elements, hidden at the bottom of the bag, were strawberry hard candies, gumdrops, and chewing gum. For her husband, Jorah, she brought 2 boxes of ammunition and a new pair of sheep shears. Collectively, these goods had only cost her a fraction of her 4 months' midwife salary. The rest resided in the toes of her boots. The valley stretched out behind her. The tracks she'd left were already erased. When she'd stepped off the train in Deer Stand mid-morning, the snow had been a lazy flurry, but the closer she got to home, the deeper the snow became, and the more furiously it fell. It was as if she thought God wanted to keep outsiders away as much as the Howells did. "We are an ark unto ourselves, waiting for the floodwaters to rise," her husband Jorah liked to say. She heard his calming voice in her ears over the sighing of the wind and the whisper of wet snowflakes, and she missed him. She longed for his silken hair against her cheek at night, his soft footsteps as he left in the morning to milk, and his smell of leaves, of smoke, of outdoor air. She'd meant to come home in October. Pardon me. The baby had been born before the snow covered the earth, and she went by every day to check on its well-being, to touch each of its little fingers and their pearly nails. The child grew as October gave way to November, and the calendar flirted with December. The city, any city, always had need for a midwife. Even that morning, looking out the window, warm by the fire, she couldn't bring herself to leave, and failed to get on the train before dawn had broken, revealing a clear, bright day. Still a ways from home, something nagged at the back of her mind, threatening to push her forward and topple her. She hurried, but the rush made for careless steps. The path shrank, and she passed between naked oaks and shivering pines. The light emanating from the snow turned the color of a new bruise as the day died, glowing just enough to mark her way. The terrain leveled again and broke through the woods. Elspeth knew by the rolling of the ground that she was crossing the cornfields, the dead stalks cracked beneath the ice and snow. She tromped alongside the creek that brought them their water, frozen at the surface but trickling below. It was then that the fear that had been tugging at her identified itself. It was nothing. No smell of a winter fire, no whoops from the boys rounding up the sheep or herding the cows, no welcoming light. She crested the last rise. The house nestled in the bosom of the hill. The small plateau seemed made for them, chiseled by God for their security, to hold them like a perfect secret. She held her breath, hoping for some hint of life, and heard nothing but the far-off snap of a branch. Everything stood still. She could not make out the smoke from the chimney, and despite the late hour, no lamp shone in the windows. Elspeth began to run. She tripped, and her pack shoved her into the snow. Clawing with her hands, digging with her feet, she pushed herself upright and rushed towards home. Closer, she noticed a hollow in the snow next to the front door. A bear, she thought, a wolf, but nausea welled in her belly and said different. A glimpse of color spurred her on. The hole drew her toward it, and she feared that it would swallow her, as she'd once seen from this very hilltop a tornado envelop a 100-foot oak and leave nothing but a ragged gap where the roots had been. The color flickered again, and a small swatch of red reaching out from the darkness like the devil's forked tongue. The screen door clapped against the house as Elspeth pitched herself forward and fell to her knees. There, dressed in her nightgown, lay Emma, the youngest, her blonde curls matted with blood. The red ribbon holding her hair waved in the wind, almost free. The snow had melted and then refrozen in an obsidian mass beneath her. A fine layer of powder had settled on her gown and face, and Elspeth removed her gloves to brush it away. The child had been shot. The cold had puckered around the clean bullet wound on her forehead, the blood there, a thin red ring. Elspeth whimpered a small, ferocious noise. If these images didn't cause Elspeth instant pulsing revulsion, Emma might merely be sleeping. The snow gone, her hair in place, Emma looked more like herself, and that made Elspeth's pain burn brighter. She wished to call out, to scream for someone to help, but their ark had been chosen for its isolation. Deerstand was the nearest town, a 6-hour walk that Elspeth had barely made in daylight. She looked to the barn, where Caleb slept, and saw no signs of life there, either. The cold that they warded off with their structures and their fires had won. No warmth lingered on the hill. Nothing could be done. No help could be summoned. The screen door creaked behind her, and Elspeth pushed open the front door. The house, usually heated to bursting on an early winter's night, offered no respite from the cold. The kerosene lamp stood unlit in the middle of the kitchen table, the matches beside it. She removed her pack and shook the snow from her hat and shoulders, stalling. She didn't want to see what the light would offer. In the darkness, she grasped the coat rack Jesse had built. Coats hung on every hook. They were cold. She bent down and touched the neat alignment of shoes and boots beneath the windowsill next to the door and found no puddle of melted snow beneath them. She left her own buttons fastened and her laces tied tight. She struck a match and touched it to the soak wick of the lamp, the brightness causing her to turn away. She adjusted the flame and let her vision acclimate. So that's one point of view. And the other point of view character is Caleb, who is her son.
How old is he again?
He's 12 years old. The pantry smelled of gunpowder. The acrid smoke swirled and then disappeared, sucked through the hole in the wall created by the elbow of Caleb Howell and the kick of his gun. His prized possession, a 12-gauge Ithaca shotgun. The 30-inch barrel ran most of the width of the pantry, leaving no room for recoil. 6 more paper-shot shells sat in the mass of blankets between his legs. He cleared the spent rounds, still smoking, and awkwardly loaded 2 more before pressing his face to the pantry door and looking through the hole created by the shot. It was warm on his cheek. He'd heard the grunt as the pellets hit and the scraping of the table legs as the murderer's body dragged it across the kitchen floor. Through the smoldering gap in the wood, he saw one hand draped over the side of the table, blood dripping steadily from the index and middle fingers. The steady tap helped him keep time. He waited for 20, then another set of 20. Caleb couldn't count higher than that. Moments before, it had been comforting in his delirium to hear sounds again, other than the fabrications of his terror and the incessant moan of the wind through the bullet holes and the scratching of the elm against the roof. He had been asleep when the men had come last. The first shot had sent him scrambling to the edge of the hayloft door. The sun threatened to rise. His sister, who'd been coming to fetch him for breakfast as she did most mornings, lay in the snow. When the men stepped into the doorway and over the threshold, Caleb caught only a few details. The long beard of the first, the gangly, unsteady legs of the second, like a newborn calf, and the way the third moved, like water. Each carried a gun, each wore a red scarf. The bearded one dangled his loose about his shoulders. The gangly one wrapped his around his neck, and the third had tied his long hair back with his. Caleb heard another shot and moved into the darkness of the loft. The crack of gunfire kept coming, and he willed himself to press his eye to a knot in the rough wood. They emerged from the house, the three of them, and the gangly one glanced towards the barn. Caleb's pants grew wet, and he backed up, wriggling down into the hay, covering himself, his hands clenching at the straw. Sometime later, maybe minutes, maybe hours, he thought he heard voices, and then nothing. When he finally rose and picked the hay from his clothing, the house was dark. Emma's body was only a small shadow. He climbed down from the loft and fetched his gun from the rack at the rear of the barn. Ithaca in hand, he sprinted across the yard, head swiveling, certain he saw red scarves behind every tree. He paused and, with a careful touch, brushed the snow from Emma's face. Once inside, he passed through each room as quickly as he could, running past the horror so he could not fully take it in, shoving open his parents' door, the smell of gunpowder still strong, his father's rifle untouched in the corner. On his way back through the house, searching for any remote speck of life, a groan, a twitch, he was met with stillness beyond his imagination. It made so little sense to him that he pressed his hand to his mouth until his jaw hurt, for he feared he would laugh, his throat and stomach dancing with the possibility. When that subsided, he grabbed his wrist with his hand and hugged himself hard. He couldn't leave the bodies, didn't want to be so alone, and he hid in the pantry where he felt safe, confined. The moaning of the wind accompanied his sobbing while he waited for the three men to return. In the depths of night, he emerged to stretch, check for signs of intruders, and wipe Emma's face and body clean from the snow that never seemed to stop falling, then crept back into the pantry where he waited with his loaded gun. He'd been asleep again, but this time he woke and did not wait, did not let his hand prove unsteady or his legs grow wet. This time he had been brave. This time he had done what his father had been unable to. He'd protected them. So that's Caleb. Thanks. Now I'm going to read just a little bit of the, pardon me, of the two of them. I'm skipping ahead a little bit. All you need to know, there's a lot that happens in between these two, but, is that they decided to go in search of the killers. And they're leaving the house. And then the other thing, which has sort of been mentioned sort of peripherally within what I've read, is that Caleb has been living in the barn and loves the animals very, very dearly. They're sort of like his family. He takes care of them, and that's where his home really is. So leaving is obviously a very complicated thing for him. He's also never left their farm before. Though from the state of her injuries and the fact that she'd woken in Jorah's clothes, she presumed that Caleb had seen her body, Elspeth retreated into the back of the barn out of modesty and wrapped bandages around her chest, drawing them tight with her teeth until it hurt to breathe, the fabric groaning each time she did. Caleb paused at the top of the ladder, wiping sleep from his eyes. His mother fastened her bandages with a series of pins that made her look as though she'd been stitched together with metal. "It's time," she said. "What about the animals?" he asked. Elspeth put one arm and then the other into the sleeves of Jorah's shirt, trying to ignore the pain, knowing that worse, much worse, would come. To leave the animals must be hard for the boy, she thought, and their eyes followed her with rapt attention, awaiting their fate. Their snorts and shuffling steps amplified in her head. "Perhaps we set them free," she said. "They'll die," Caleb answered. While he stood within a yard of his bed and his feeble belongings, his heart begged for a few more moments of childhood. He forgave himself his whining. He pictured his animals roaming the hillside sickly and weak. He hoped he'd meant much to them. "They won't know what to do," he said. "You could stay," she offered. He came down the ladder, his 12-year-old form so small in that giant space. The animals didn't care, she thought, that he'd buttoned his shirt incorrectly and it hung crookedly over his tiny frame, or that his hair stood on end in the morning and then flopped into his face by midday. He'd found his place. Her head and stomach eased at the thought of walking off by herself, like she had a dozen times since she and Jorah had settled in their small nook on the shaded side of the hill. Staying had, of course, occurred to Caleb. His mother had said it aloud, and so it pushed its way to the front of his thoughts and hung in the air in front of him, easy enough to grab. He could live like this forever among the animals. But his mind had been made up, and his family depended on him, and he walked down the rows of pens, unlatching them as he went, unable to look at the expectant faces. While the chickens milled about under his feet, he slid the pack over his shoulders and took the Ithaca shotgun and Jorah's rifle in hand. They swung the doors open. The cold air gripped their skin and turned their lips dry, and they tugged their scarves up to cover their mouths. The snow crunched underfoot. Caleb fought the urge to look back. The faint sounds of his animals called to him, begged him to reconsider. But then he passed the small lump of snow where his brothers and sisters lay entangled in each other's arms, and his resolve hardened. He hitched his bags higher up onto his shoulders. Legs heavy and head dull, Elspeth stared at the empty space where her home had once stood. She saw the four stone grave markers and the line of Caleb's footprints that had drawn to them. She prayed silently, asking for a safe journey for both herself and Caleb on their mission, and also for her children and her husband as they sought their way to heaven. Abraham had been willing to kill his son for God, and so he spared them both. On the altar of sacrifice that receded with each step, she had given not one but four children and a husband. She wondered whether God had become so much crueler with the passage of time. Instead of giving thanks for what she'd been spared, she grew angry at what had been taken from her, and a hunger grew deep in the pit of her to find the men responsible and snatch everything from them with equal cruelty. Thank you. So, happy stuff. Some of the reviews have said that the book is not for the faint of heart. And at first I thought, oh no, I wrote a book that's too scary or something, or too dark. But then the more I thought about it, the more I thought, like, I don't want to know anyone who's faint of heart. I don't want to know anyone who's like, yeah, no, it's too much for me. And some of the scenes that, pardon me, some of the scenes that I just read, especially some of the stuff with Emma, is sort of some of the more violent passages in the book until much later. So I don't know. It doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother me anymore. I actually kind of will wear it as a badge of honor. So anyway, so I think I'll take questions if anyone has them. Yes.
I'm curious, how long did it take you from when you first had the idea for this book? Did you have a concept of the length of the book when you first started? I'm just sort of interested in how it's structured in your mind.
So the question is how long the book took me to write and sort of the basic overview of how that came about. I had the idea for the book, I think, in 1999, maybe. And one of the reasons why I read the passages that I read is the image that first occurred to me is this image of Caleb wiping the snow from Emma's face. And it was just something I just couldn't let go of it. I don't know where it came from. I don't know, you know, why it sort of meant so much to me. But I started trying to write the novel then and quickly, thankfully, decided that I was awful. And I wrote something else instead that was kind of funny and light that was really awful. And then I wrote two novels and that were really, you know, not good. And I realized after writing the second one that there were a lot of tools that I just didn't possess. And so I went to graduate school and I started the book in graduate school. And so it's been about 8.5 years or 9 years since then. Which is a long time, but I didn't think that I'd ever get to a point where I would read it or go over it with an editor and think, oh, it's done. you know, I'm done. I can put this away now, because you can always tinker with stuff and you can always sort of figure out different ways to do things. But I never got to the point where I sort of just like adding and subtracting commas. I never got to the point where I was, you know, just adding and subtracting seemingly just because of something to do. I really felt like I was always progressing over all those, you know, 8.5 years. And then the last time is this really amazing thing. The last time I went through the book with the proofreader, she asked me some questions that I hadn't been able to sort of figure out myself. I mean, I didn't even know what they were, but she said, oh, this wouldn't happen because this happened. I mean, they were sort of like really obvious big picture things, but for those of us, like my editor and my agent who'd read the book 10 or 11 times, they're just so hard to see. And she just pointed them out like that. And once I fixed those things, I thought, oh, I'm done. And it had never, I'd never ever thought that I would get there. So it was a really, it was a great feeling. Yeah. Yes.
When you're in the process of writing, as an author, do you have an ability to turn it off when you want to go to sleep? Or do you kind of keep thinking of different avenues you might take when you keep writing tomorrow?
That's a great question. The question is if when I'm writing, if I can turn it off at night, and where it sort of stops, right? It doesn't. I mean, it doesn't really stop. I mean, I always want to write. And if I don't for a few days in a row, I get really anxious. Like, I'm a fairly anxious person anyway, but I'll really get, you know, antsy. Like, if anyone here is like a runner or something like that, if you haven't run in a few days, you get this thing in your body sort of like thrumming. And that's what it's like for me if I haven't written in a couple days. But if I'm working on something specific, I will then, this is kind of embarrassing, I will watch really bad television just for like half an hour. Otherwise, I won't be able to sleep because I will, you're right, I'll just keep turning over and over and over in my head, and I won't be able to go to bed. Because I'll just keep doing it, and eventually I'll just say, oh, it's not going to happen. I'll just get up, and I'll just keep writing. But if I mean, sometimes I can watch sports or something, and that'll do it. But other times I'll watch really bad, like sitcoms and stuff that I would otherwise not watch. And I write really late at night, too, so there's lots to choose from. You know, 3:30 in the morning, there are a lot of bad sitcoms that you can choose from. So thank you. That's a great question. Yes. Yeah, the question is whether I have sort of real life experiences that are feeding into the book, and whether I have a strong connection to this place, to the place that I'm describing. I live in Western Massachusetts now, and I lived there until I was 10, and then my family moved to upstate New York, which is where this is set roughly. But my grandparents lived in Syracuse, New York. And making that drive, which I hope none of you have ever had to do, from Boston to Syracuse, or even north of Syracuse, where my grandfather used to keep a boat, and my dad has a cottage now. That landscape, which is sort of, it's wide open and barren. You wouldn't think of it unless you've seen it. You wouldn't really sort of know it's there, I don't think. It's not how you sort of picture upstate New York, sort of like a blah something mess, you know, just like steely gray. And that is what it's like. But I also, I'd read a lot of Southern Gothic literature and sort of like things that might be considered Westernish, you know, sort of Cormac McCarthy. And I love Flannery O'Connor and people like that. And I'd read them when I was really young. But I'd never been to the South and I'd never been to the Midwest. And so I sort of put those stories in the only place that I could see them happening, and that was that place in upstate New York. And so that's sort of how it all kind of like fell together for me. And I knew that I always wanted to write something sort of in this vein that was in that area because of that feeling. And the landscape. Two, the other thing that happens there that's not described in these other novels, because it's obviously very different landscapes and climates, is these lake effect snows. that they have over there, where when the snow gathers over the Great Lakes, it's just this wall of clouds. And when it comes in, the snow falls so fast, and it's just sheets of snow. And it's really oppressive, and it's really isolating. And this family is so isolated, and I thought that just like those skies were perfect for to set a book like this. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Do you think you'll return to that same kind of scene for the
next book? The question is whether I would write another book set there. I don't know. It takes me a while to be away from a place to be able to write about it. Otherwise, it's sort of too clear in my head. I also find, too, I don't know if other people in the room are writers, but if I have a really clear concept of like, okay, today I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write this scene, and it's these people, and they're going to be doing this, I have a really hard time doing it the clearer my concept of it is. So I think those two things are kind of similar. Like, they're sort of in the same vein. If it's too clear, I can't do it. But I have started another novel. It's set in Vermont, which is where I went to college and spent a little bit of time after college. excuse me. And I think that that separation from not having been there for 15 years or so is what will enable me to sort of see it more clearly. So, yeah, thank you. Yes.
So you've been a 12-year-old boy.
I have. I have been a 12-year-old boy.
And a mother and a woman. So. Mm-hmm.
I love this question. The question is whether I found it easier to write from Elspeth's point of view as the point of view of a mother, or whether I found it easier to write from Caleb's point of view as a 12-year-old boy. And the answer is actually I found Elspeth much easier for me to understand. If you read the book, she is not... I mean, from the first line, you know that she's not the world's best person. But I feel like she has... you know, compulsions, and I feel like she makes decisions that are just bad. I mean, they just sort of, they overwhelm all of her sort of morals and all of these things that she's sort of, you know, been not programmed, certainly not at that time, but sort of, you know, she grew up, with her parents basically were servants for this very, rich family, also in upstate New York, and she and her husband are basically cast out. And I think there was something about that and the fact that she sort of hasn't had the right people around her or the right role model. She's never sort of been taught to be her own person. There was something about that I really understood. Whereas Caleb sort of hasn't had any experiences and he's kind of a blank slate. And I found that a lot harder to write, because I was a pretty intense kid. So, but then again, you know, I wouldn't have the bravery to do 99.9% of the things he does in the book. But the funny thing, again, you know, if there are any writers in the room, I don't know if they feel the same way, but knowing her better meant that I didn't write her as well, because she was so much closer to my own personality. So I filled in all the gaps on my own. And so But Caleb, I didn't understand, and so I figured him out on the page. So when I went back to edit, I had to figure out how do I describe myself, kind of in a way, in describing Elspeth, whereas Caleb, it was all there because I'd figured it out on the page. So, yeah. Yes?
I guess I'm interested as to why you have two different narrators to begin with.
Oh. Mm-hmm. The question is why two narrators? I think that's a really good question that I haven't thought about in such a long time. It was there from the very, very beginning. And I will tell you, and this might be related to the last question, that when several people read the book in an early draft, they thought that Elspeth should die. Basically like 30 pages in. And there's something that I really liked about that in a weird way, in the sort of like, you know, like Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, you know, when Janet Leigh gets killed and it was like this shocking thing. She's like a top bill star, right? And you're like, oh my goodness, I thought we were going to be with this person the whole time. And then she's gone. And so there was something about the shock of that that I really thought was kind of cool. And I thought about it for a while, but I was just way too interested in her, and I was too interested in him too. And throughout the book, they do this thing where they sort of, you know, come apart and intersect and come apart and intersect and come apart and intersect. And I wanted to be able to tell both of those, you know, sort of both of their tales in that way. But because of that, the book originally, first draft, was like 550 pages or so. And it's, you know, it's like 340 or something now. So it's, yeah. A lot of cutting. Yes.
Very simplistic question, I guess. But
I love those. I love simple questions.
I find that whatever is in my mind flows better through my hands when I use a pen or pencil. Hmm. And I wonder if you write with a pen or pencil, or do you write with a computer?
Oh, that's a good question. The question is whether I write with a pen or pencil or a computer. I actually write on a computer now, but I used to do a lot of visual art, and so I understand the physicality of that, and I enjoy it a lot, but it's not fast enough for me. The way that I look at the language and stuff, like, I just need to be constantly moving stuff around. It's too hard if I do it in longhand. But the one thing that I do is I print everything out, and I read it aloud, and I mark it up, and I also will cut it apart scene by scene and hang it on the wall. And the physicality of that is enough for me to sort of move the scenes around and move the lines around and see how they're speaking to one another and see if they're operating in the proper order and in the proper way. So that gives me some measure of that, which because I really do enjoy that sort of hands-on aspect of it. Oh, thank you. Yes. What do I consider my strength as a writer? I think the reason that I wanted to go to graduate school is because I'd worked in a literary agency, and I'd worked for production companies, and I'd read a lot of screenplays, and I'd done sort of script writing in college too. I'd always written fiction as well. But I think that sort of ingrained in me structure and story and arcs and like all the things that you need to have to make a narrative build on itself. So those were things that I had sort of always had. And I told stories a lot as a kid. I wrote a lot as a kid too. And I think that your early concept of a writer is just someone who tells stories. And the thing that was harder for me was the line by line writing and the language and that kind of stuff. And that really took going to school and learning from people, literally. I mean, learning how to write a sentence. I think I did have some sort of rhythm to my writing, but in terms of figuring out what works and what doesn't work, and some of it's really simple. I mean, you know, don't repeat words. Your job is to pick the words, so don't pick the same word over and over. To the point where now, actually, you know, doing this reading tonight, because I'm sort of like reading in different sections, I read a couple words and they sort of stuck out to me because I like alarm bells go off. I mean, they're like 30 pages apart or whatever, but I repeated a couple words within those two sections and it really bothered me, you know? Yeah. In the text, it doesn't bother me at all because they're far enough apart, but reading it right now, it makes my skin crawl a little bit. And that's one of the things that, you know, 10 years ago, I had no idea that was a thing. So some of them are really simple, but a lot of them are more complicated than that. Thanks for the question. Yes.
What do you like to read?
What do I like to read? I read very widely, actually. I mean, some of my favorite writers are people who you might expect from the book. I like Cormac McCarthy a lot. I like Daniel Woodrell a lot. Flannery O'Connor, Carson McCullers, Tom Franklin. But then I love Kazuo Ishiguro, who wrote Remains of the Day and Never Let Me Go, which is my favorite book of his. He just has this astonishing clarity. I learned so much from reading that book, especially. I read it when I was in graduate school, and I just, it's just to die for. It's so amazing. Marilynne Robinson. I love Marilynne Robinson. Housekeeping is one of my other favorite books of all time. It's the only book that I reread every year. I just think that, you know, she and Cormac McCarthy both have this sort of like biblical rhythm and tone almost. And that's something that I think you have to be raised in. And so I'm jealous of it. I can't do it. I wish I could, but it's really gorgeous the way that they can match this sort of like biblical cadence with these beautiful images. So, I love them. I love David Foster Wallace. I just like people who just say, let me see if I can get away with this. And then sometimes they do for 800 pages. I find that really, really remarkable. He just sort of throws it all out there and he's so unbelievably intelligent. So those are some of my favorites. I'm trying to think. Last year, I mostly read short story collections. There were so many great short story collections last year. The George Saunders, Laura Vandenberg, Nina McLaughlin, there's Jamie Quatro. I read the Outlaw album, which was Daniel Woodrell's collection last year, but it came out maybe 2 or 3 years ago. But it was last year was the year of the short story for me. I mostly read short story collections. So. Yeah. Yes. yeah. When this becomes a movie, can it be based in Colorado? I don't know. It depends on the tax breaks. That's how films work. Yeah. I mean, Massachusetts used to get no movies and then they did all these crazy tax breaks and now they're shooting films there all the time. I just saw American Hustle and I was like, that's my dry cleaners. So I think, though, you know, I mean, we talk about stuff like that, about, you know, filmic possibilities and stuff. I'm really picky about filmmakers. And I mean, I'll watch, like I said, I'll watch anything at 2:30 in the morning. But in terms of films and filmmakers, I'm really picky. So absolutely not. No, I don't want to have anything to do with it, actually. Even though I love film and I did some screenwriting, I just wouldn't want to. I think to make a good film, you need to be able to rip it apart. And I don't think that I could do that successfully. So yeah, so we'll see what happens. I mean, hope so. Fingers crossed.
I'll definitely watch
that. Oh, good. Okay. Oh, good. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.